I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. On August 3rd, 2019, the border city of El Paso, Texas was forever changed. 1 year ago today, a gunman shot and killed 23 people in a Walmart in El Paso. The gunman had written and published a white supremacist manifesto just moments before the attack. The massacre is considered to be one of the deadliest anti-Latino attacks in modern U.S. history. The victims included both adults and children, and both U.S. and Mexican citizens, many of whom had crossed into town to shop at the Walmart. 1 year on, we're going to check in on El Paso and what justice looks like, or what it should look like, for survivors and their families, many of whom have also faced the brunt of years of border policies from the United States and Mexican governments. I'm joined now by two guests. Renee Klajic is a reporter for El Paso Matters. Renee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Monica Martinez is a historian and the author of The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. Monica joined us last year to discuss the shooting when it first happened. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Monica.
Thank you for having me.
Renee, let's start with you. What do we know about the victims and the survivors of the shooting today?
Well, you know, it's important to remember that both victims and survivors are that this was a binational tragedy, and that people were targeted who were from both the United States and Mexico. There have been 23 dead from this tragedy, and, you know, El Paso, we're a resilient community, but there are still people hospitalized from injuries sustained during the shooting. So there's still so much pain, and a year later, we're still struggling to kind of reconcile all the pain that this tragedy caused.
Monica, you joined us after the shooting last year to talk about how that incident and that shooting fits into the history of anti-Latino violence at the border. What's on your mind today, 1 year later?
Well, in my work, Reckoning with Histories of Racial Violence, I've seen that we have to think about the multiple steps required for seeking justice. So this means, of course, prosecuting those accountable for committing horrific acts of violence like this massacre, but also thinking about the systems that allowed these acts of racial violence to occur in the first place. So we have to consider collective responsibility for human rights violations. And so that's really a call for everybody to consider what we have to be doing as individuals to try to reckon this horrific act. Congresswoman Veronica Escobar recently described the massacre as a result of two different pandemics, first gun violence and second hate against Latinos. And I think she's absolutely right. So, you know, we can think about hate as a pandemic, as a social illness. And that's actually how anti-lynching activists 100 years ago taught Americans about the immorality of lynchings. And so it's a useful analogy for today because we can think about the multiple symptoms of hate that has been targeted against Latinos, right? Hate spreads like a disease. So when presidents or governors or senators or the media use racist rhetoric, it spreads hate and it actually inspires hate crimes and acts of domestic violence. We're seeing that today, and we saw that take place 100 years ago. And we can think about the different kind of symptoms of anti-Latino hate. First, there's the undeniable increase in hate crimes that have been reported by the FBI and by other watch groups. The massacre in El Paso is the most egregious of these in the past year. But we also have to think about the second kind of symptoms, which takes place in policy, brutal border policing and draconian immigration policies like family separation, right? I think about the over 5,000 children that were separated from their families. I think about that as being a crime against humanity. And a third symptom of anti-Latino hate is that racist and dehumanizing representations of Latinos is so effective that everyday Americans who don't see themselves as hating Latinos, they still tolerate this inhumane treatment, the brutal policing, and the regular violation of rights of both foreign nationals and American citizens. So society as a whole is infected with discriminatory perceptions that allow society to condone this kind of injustice. And so we really need an awakening for people to call for drastic reforms, but also to change our own perceptions that allow us to condone this kind of behavior.
Renee, when you think about, I mean, you're originally from El Paso and you moved back earlier this year. How has the community changed in the past year?
I mean, if we're looking for a silver lining, I think it's that this horrific mass shooting has made a lot of El Pasoans realize how much they love this community and how much they want to work to protect it. So there's been such a surge of local pride in response to it. You know, the hashtag El Paso Strong is ubiquitous. When you drive around the city, you see murals, you see bumper stickers. And I mean, today and this weekend, there have been so many different types of memorialization, lots of socially distanced COVID forms of collective memorializing. I think there was a drive-through memorial last night. But, you know, just an outpouring of love for this community, and not just El Paso. Like I said, you know, we're a binational community, and people on both sides of the border are both mourning but also expressing solidarity. And I think that if anything, our community has become stronger and more resilient in the face of this hate-fueled act, and that love for this area has grown, and you know, so many people have realized how special it is. I mean, even as someone who has moved back home in the time since the shooting happened, I feel a tremendous amount of pride to be from El Paso. And part of why this area is so special is because we're a border community, because we're a binational community. That's our strength. So I think that's been a real lesson, has been seeing that outpouring of love and local pride.
Monica, El Paso, as we mentioned, is a border town, and some of the victims of the massacre were Mexican citizens. Has that in any way influenced the commemoration of the shooting or the aftermath of the shooting?
Well, I think absolutely. And you know, it's not lost on me that historically, border communities that thrive, right, where you see people not seeing an international border as a division, but seeing, you know, that these communities, both Juarez and El Paso, have grown as cities in strength together over time, that those kinds of communities have been under attack. Those were targeted with violence, especially because they embody a spirit of living sin fronteras, right? That these are people who are united. Soccer teams, you know, that play on both sides of the border, children that move back and forth for schooling, families that live on both sides, people who own businesses on both sides and work on both sides. And to see that kind of a community attacked is especially horrific, right? Because it's an attack on that way of life.
Renee, let me ask you here about how white supremacy has played out in that region. I mean, El Paso also has a history of racism. Monica has done a lot of work on the long tail history here, but more recently, how would you say that's played out?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely correct that, you know, the ideologies that fueled this act are not new to the borderlands. We've had a long history of racism and of white supremacy and ideologies of white supremacy that have shaped and framed this community both institutionally and implicitly. I mean, there, you know, throughout El Paso's history, there has been de facto segregation, racial covenants for homeowners. There's been a movement in El Paso recently to change the names of some schools. Robert E. Lee Elementary School has a renaming process in effect right now. There were also six school names that were named by the KKK when the KKK took power of the school board in El Paso in 1922. And there is some discussion about changing those names because those schools were named after slave owners, slave traders. So that conversation's happening. But the, you know, there's a powerful legacy of racism in this community. And I mean, even the way that the military-industrial apparatus at the border is constructed, you know, there was a quarantine policy here for over 40 years that forcibly bathed Mexicans in chemicals when they were entering this country. That, you know, people don't know about that history. Most, like El Pasoans, don't know about that history, even though that policy was in effect here for, you know, almost half a century. So those things leave a strong imprint of racism and inequality on a community, and they have shaped how people have lived their lives here, and how, even though we are a binational community and we're completely interconnected, there's also pronounced inequality along lines of race, indigeneity, you know, class, and all of those things are interconnected.
Monica, when we look at, you mentioned a lot of this in the earlier segment, just in terms of how violence against Latinos has been perpetrated. But I wonder, Have we learned anything from the El Paso shooting? When we look at the country more broadly and we look at how the state of anti-Latino violence in this country, has anything changed since a year ago?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't seen change, and it's devastating. I think that when we were last speaking, you know, we were sort of there were still ongoing conversations about family separation, and that being a flashpoint for Americans to sort of have a new consciousness to say our immigration policies need to be changed. During the Democratic presidential debates, I was really taken aback by, I really think that what we need is Americans to vote, right? And to be committed to removing local, state, and federal administrations and elected officials who continue to circulate anti-Latino hateful rhetoric and who continue to endorse draconian immigration policies. You know, family separation is something that is still ongoing today, right? The COVID-19 pandemic and epidemic has only emboldened our current federal administration to continue to encourage and to inflict upon parents making these terrible choices between, you know, allowing their children to be separated from them and released from detention when the federal administration has every authority to release families together. And so I think that we still, 100 years later, are too often separating, right? We give too much authority to the federal government to create, to commit these crimes against humanity. And we separate those actions from the brutality of the horrific act of this massacre in El Paso. And we have to think about them as social ills that have to be remedied at the same time, right? We have to condemn white power, domestic terror actions, but we also have to condemn governors and senators and presidents and local officials that continue to perpetuate this kind of fear and division and racial hostility. So, you know, one of the most powerful ways that Latinos can memorialize the victims in El Paso and stand against this violence and hate is to vote, to show our strength in numbers, and to remind anyone who believes otherwise that we are not going anywhere, that our voices will be heard, and that we are demanding reform and we are demanding justice.
Renee, I'm just thinking as Monica's talking about government officials and what they can and should do differently. Beto O'Rourke was running for president when this happened a year ago. I'm wondering whether or not he's continued to be involved at any point in the memorials for the victims?
You know what? I'm not sure. I know that he's been interviewed for some like year later segments, but I'm not certain to what extent he's been involved in local memorials. I would imagine so.
What are those memorials looking like, Renee? I mean, we are also, as Monica mentioned, we are in the middle of a pandemic, and there are the rules have changed decidedly for how we engage with each other socially. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what these memorials or commemorations of the anniversary of the shooting are looking like, given COVID-19 restrictions.
Absolutely. You know, I'll tell you about one especially that I found really moving. A number of local florists came together and created 23 floral sculptures of human forms made out of grass and plants and flowers to commemorate each of the 23 people who died. And the sculpture for the youngest person who died, the 15-year-old, they covered with the most flowers because they said that person had not yet fully bloomed when their life was cut short, which I found so moving. But that memorial and many others were drive-by. There have been lots of luminarias, which is when you put like a candle in a paper bag. It's something very common here for Christmas to drive through a neighborhood and illuminate the roadway with luminarias. But yet lots of different forms of collective expression, you know, online gatherings, drive-by memorials, and then an incredible amount of public art as well that we've seen over the entire year, but also right now. I mean, like this floral art installation that I mentioned, there have been so many different types of visual like changes to the visual landscape to commemorate this tragedy, to indicate that we won't forget and that we are a strong, united community in the face of hate and in response to it. Creating beauty in response to it. It's really been very moving to see.
Renee Klajic is a reporter for El Paso Matters, and Monica Munoz Martinez is a historian and the author of The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Me.